You're listening to Face Off, episode 21, recorded June 7th, 2009. Face Off. You're listening to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we'd like to talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes at faceoffshow.com or follow us by going to twitter.com/faceoffshow.
All right, we got some news and follow-ups this week. The first one is kind of an arts and crafts project a little bit. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, so this weekend, Mark and I wanted to do a little prep for recording and try and improve, you know, improve the show and kind of how we recorded. So we actually found a little article online that you can get to in the show notes where we were able to make our own pop filter.
And a pop filter is basically for P's and B sounds. Yeah. The air that's coming out of your mouth kind of like makes a really loud noise in the mic and it pops.
Yeah. So it doesn't really affect my microphone that much because I don't have a condenser microphone like yours. But if you notice that this week that Mark's P's are not quite so loud, then that's because we built our own little homemade pop filters. It's quite fun. I actually haven't had an arts and crafts project like that in quite some time.
Yeah. Well, we were going to buy one because we kind of, well, at least I needed one. And we found this site that allowed us to make our own, and it actually worked out great. They work great.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
And it was really cheap.
It's really, all a pop filter is sort of a, like a piece of cloth or light metal that just slows down the air when you do big, massive air pushes with, like, P's and sounds like that.
Yeah, so, without, like, muffling your voice too much.
So we got, like, they're basically embroidery hoops with some pantyhose over them, and that was an experience, two guys walking into Target and buying pantyhose, but the checkout lady was pretty cool about it. She didn't give us any weird eyes, but, yeah, they work. It was fun.
Yeah.
So the next piece of news and follow-up that we have is, was it last week or 2 weeks ago we talked about Google Wave? One of the really cool features of Google Wave that we thought was they had a bot that would sort of actively translate things that you were typing. And that was really cool. Mm-hmm. But in, you know, sort of our lookings for web apps this week, we found one that was called nicetranslator.com, which did exactly kind of that. It didn't do it. You know, the nice part about the Wave bot was it did it sort of inside your Wave, inside your conversation on the fly.
Yeah, if you were having like an IM conversation, you'd want to have it in there, where this is, you'd have to like copy and paste or something. But
exactly. But this one, it's Ajax. So, you know, as you type it, you can watch it translate it. You can pick all kinds of languages. There's, you know, the one language Mark knows a little bit of was Norwegian. So we did Norwegian. And it can go either way. It can go from Norwegian to any other language, or... you know, you can select multiple languages, so it'll translate in, you know, let's say four different languages at once. And the one thing we actually found that was fairly impressive was that it tried to do it correctly. It didn't just translate word for word, right, like some translators do. It tries to, you know, in context and things like that, you mm-hmm. know?
So mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not word for word. It'll rearrange the words according to the syntax of the language you're trying to convert it to. So
exactly.
It appears at least it's as smart as the Google one. So it's,
yeah. And it was Ajax. So I mean, one of the things about Google Wave is they're like, as you type, it translates. And this does that too. I mean, you'd have to copy and paste your conversation. It's nice that the Google Wave one does it sort of in conversation, but this one worked really well. And we thought it was really cool. Like we were writing stuff in Arabic and it, you know, did like the Arabic characters and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It was really, really cool. I was impressed. So nicetranslator.com. All right, so Mark, let's dig into our web apps. That was kind of a web app, but so the first one we want to talk about is wishmirror.com. What is wishmirror.com, Mark?
Wishmirror was kind of created to let people, you know, build wish lists, exchange gifts, you know, people exchange gifts, you know, any event really, actually. You can make different events for it. You know how like Amazon's got like a wish list where you can say, you can give it to somebody and say, hey, these are some of my things that I'd like to get or something, if you're looking to give exactly. me a gift. But the problem with Amazon is it's on one site. You kind of want something that's cross-site, exactly. you know.
Yeah, Amazon, as much as we like to think it has everything, it might not have everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, or it might not have the best price on something, too.
Mm-hmm.
So what this does is you go in and... by default, it asks you for your birthday, but you can create other events too. You can create recurring events like an anniversary, or you can create one-time events like a graduation, and create like you can create a wish list just for that event. You also can add people and add groups to it. So let's say I have a group of work people that, you know, we're going to have like a work going away party or something. So I create a wish list for a going away party. But there's some things, you know, I might not want on my work wish list that my coworkers would see, you know.
So you can restrict it to certain groups of people. So like if it's an anniversary, you can only let certain people, you know, the wife or somebody to see it.
Versus, yeah,
you know,
exactly. Like, so if I have a bunch of work people and a bunch of friends, let's say I'm having a party that is really not work related. I don't want my work people to see that. I can create a group, you know, called family and only let them see it, or friends and only let them see it. Which is nice, because sometimes you might have personal items or something, you know, a gift I would buy for a coworker would be probably pretty different than a gift I would buy for my wife, you know, for, you know, Valentine's Day or something.
So let's say I'm on here and I'm your friend and I don't really want to get you something on the list. I think I want to try to be creative and find something else, you know, for you. Is there something that can help me with there?
Yeah, exactly. So not only do you put in your items, but you also kind of create like a profile of things that you like, you know, like your favorite sport, your favorite movies and TV shows, your favorite books, so that, you know.
So I can kind of get a little snapshot of who you are. Let's say I'm a worker and I don't know you that well.
Exactly.
I could kind of go in here, browse around and say, okay, he likes this and this. He'll probably like this.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I'm not going to put, you know, I really like football and I'm a San Francisco 49ers fan. I'm not going to put every little bit of San Francisco 49er, you know, t-shirt and hat that's out on the market on my wish list, but I would love any one of those items. So I can say, you know, okay, I'm a 49ers fan. Then go on there and be like, oh, okay, I saw a cool, you know, hat down at the mall that I could get him for the, you know, 49ers on or something. So it's it's funny because, I mean, this was an app that I thought of like a while ago that I wanted to develop, and I never got off my duff and did it again, you know, because I was like, well, you know, I personally have a wish list at Amazon and ThinkGeek, because those are the two places where I buy a lot of my stuff. But I thought, what if there's like one thing, you know, the reason I started with ThinkGeek wishlist is because none of that ThinkGeek stuff is on Amazon. Otherwise, I just would have put it on Amazon. And,
right.
And I don't want to be like, here are the 12 links from my 12 different wishlists from all the different places in the world. So here I can just put it in one spot. And I mean, it would be nice if it had a little more integration. As it is right now, when you go to add an item, you just put in the name, you just put in the approximate price. You know, you don't put a link. It doesn't do any sort of frugal searching or anything like that. Which would be nice. I mean, if I went to buy a gift for someone, it'd be cool if it did like a frugal search so I could find the cheapest one out there or something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it just needs a little more integration. But as it stands right now, it's a pretty cool little website.
Can I view your wish list without signing up?
I would assume so. I didn't actually try that. That's a good question.
Actually, I just searched for your name and I found you.
Awesome.
Although, if you've got it restricted, it kind of wants you to log in because... You know, if you've got these certain events, you're probably gonna not, you're gonna want your friends to see your gifts, your gift ideas. I don't know.
I mean, like my Amazon wish list is public.
True,
but
maybe you can make a public one.
Maybe they want you to sign in too, because so one of the benefits of Amazon is if you buy it on Amazon, you say I purchased this item for this person, so it, you know, it'll remove it from the wish list when other people look at it.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So maybe they want you to sign in, so they say if you do get this, you know, don't just look at this person's list and get them something. Get it and then mark it that you got them, so that other people won't make the same mistake. So you don't want to get, you know, five of the same thing.
So this is kind of like a wedding registry or something for any event.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of like a wedding registry. There are some features that are geared around having a bunch of members, like friends that are members of the website, that we weren't really able to test because it was just me and you.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like they've got some cool things. Like one was called I Reserved, and I think it's kind of that, you know, I already bought this for someone, don't buy it for them. This is, you know, some of the things I want, but we weren't able to fully test those because we don't have enough friends that, you know, Mark and I are pretty brave. We'll sign up for any web app, but some of the people we hang out with are a little more reserved about it. They won't just give their email address to anyone. So it's kind of, it's a hard sell sometimes to tell people, you know, sign up for this, but.
All right. So we're going to go into the next web app we got here. We've got Backup URL. Backup URL is kind of like, if you've ever been to a site that got dug or something and it just, you know, it's no longer there. Maybe it's just for a day it's gone, or maybe somebody just removed the content and it was great content. Maybe it was a bookmark you had and you go to it and it's gone now. Mm-hmm. Backup URL, what it does is it will cache a copy of a URL, kind of like Google, but it'll actually store the images and the JavaScript, mm-hmm. like pretty much everything.
And Google is automatic when it crawls, if it feels like it. I don't know the caching algorithm, but it does periodic caching of it. It does it once in a while. I don't know if it does it every time it crawls it, but this is on demand. So you go and you say, hey, I want a snapshot of this website right now.
Take at this it. Time.
And it'll go and take it for you.
And it'll give you a short URL for you to reference forever. And so, you know, you can do
it takes everything too. I mean, there's some things that Google won't do. This caches the HTML, it caches the images, it caches the CSS, it caches the JavaScript.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Google cache. I mean, the Google cache is mainly for searching.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not meant to be really looked at that much.
Yeah, it keeps like a revision of the website for searching history.
Yeah, so. Like I'm looking at a Google cache right now and it doesn't show images at all. So.
Yeah, which is
sometimes it does though, I've noticed. So I don't know.
Yeah, so
this one does.
There are a lot of possible purposes for this. One would be, you know, if you're trying to do an academic paper, maybe you would create a bunch of backup URLs for it because things do change a lot on a website. I mean, even so much as if you reference a website on a paper and they change their permalink structure, you can't get to it anymore without searching. And it's
right.
You know, then, hopefully their webmaster is smart enough to, you know, 301 or something, but that's often not the case at all.
And if you're reading your paper like 3 years later, or somebody's reading your paper 3 years later and they're like trying to go to these reference links and it's not there. Yeah,
exactly.
This is great.
So, there's all kinds. So a good example of when I wish I would have used this was a little while ago, Valve came out with an update for Team Fortress 2. And I operate Montana Fragfest and we talk a lot about Team Fortress 2. It's one of my favorite video games. And in the post, so one of the speculations is that the character that is known as a pyro is a girl. And okay. It's like this, you know, it's this character with this goofy mask that goes around setting people on fire. And so it's kind of funny that it's a girl. Well, in the blog post, when they first posted it, it said something to the effect of when the pyro hears about this, she's going to be angry. And I noticed it right away and I was like, oh, this is different. And then it was removed later. So this would have been a good way to sort of prove that I took a screenshot anyways, but like that's kind of annoying. I could have just backed up that URL right then and kept that URL and been like, hey, check out what this was this morning when it was posted.
Yeah, so you didn't have to upload a picture or whatever. You could just link to a URL.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which a picture can be manipulated. This is someone else's service that I can't manipulate. You know, it'll tell you right up there that this was a backup of this website.
Give you
at
a little
this
snapshot
time. Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of a way to say like, ha, I saw it first. You know. So backup URL, it's really cool. I mean, there's services that do this. Doug Mirror does it, but it only does it if it was on dig.com. You know, it, when something gets to the front page, it tries to cache it as soon as it's dug. Well, this is, again, an on-demand way to do it. You say, I want a backup of it right now, and it'll cache everything important. The one question we did have is if you look at the links in the cached URL, they point to backup URL backups. But it's the site is not really clear on whether or not it, you know, spiders and goes one or two links deep and caches them, or if when you click on the link, it then goes and takes a snapshot and caches it then. It's mm-hmm. not really clear. I wish they would kind of clarify that a bit more, or at least leave the links in the original URL that they are so that you know for sure. Because right now you're like, well, are you, when I click on this link, are you going to go take a snapshot of it? Or did you go one link deep and take a snapshot at that time or not? I don't know.
Yes. Yep. So... okay, well, that's about enough with backup URL. The next one we've got is CC Betty.
So CC Betty is it's a website that creates a web space for email conversations. And what's the really cool part about it is the way you use it is to just CC the email address betty@ccbetty.com.
That's pretty clever.
Yeah, so, I mean, you and I use Gmail, which Gmail is a very full-featured email client. It does a lot of really cool stuff, but a lot of people can't or won't. They just don't use it, they don't know about it, or they're forced to use Outlook in their office. So what this does is when you send an email, you just CC Betty, and make sure you CC because you want people to reply and include her when they reply so that the whole conversation gets cached on CC Betty. And so when... everything you do gets sent to her, and then she kind of, you know, this website parses it and puts it in sort of a web addressable way so that you don't have to, you know, sort through all your email to do it. So if you attach files like pictures or sound clips or anything like that, it'll be there on the web interface in an easy way to get to it. So like if it's a sound clip, it'll put it as a Flash MP3 player so you don't have to, you know, download the MP3 file and play it. If there's anything like an address in the email, it'll automatically embed a Google URL in the web space for a Google Maps to that address. If there's a date or time in it, it'll give you a way to just click and download an iCal file to add it to your favorite calendar with one click.
So a lot of these features are you know, kind of in Gmail, but like you said, you know, we've got Outlook people, you know, that they've got all the whole conversation in one window. It's not very clear, you know, when the conversation was handed over from this person to this person.
Exactly.
This makes it very clear because it basically does a layout like Gmail, but then it does additional things like embeds the actual video. Like if you link to a URL, it does like snapshots of, you know,
a snapshot of the URL at that time. Yeah, exactly.
And it's really easy to use. You just CC Betty.
Yeah, exactly.
Betty at ccbetty.com.
And anybody who doesn't have an account, they get like a nice little email from Betty saying, hey, this email conversation you're part of is on CC Betty. Here's the link to it.
Yeah, one of the cool things too is you don't actually have to sign up in order to see it. It gives you like this private URL and then you just type in your email and it lets you see it.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's going to be to your advantage to sign up.
Yeah, exactly.
But one thing that we kind of didn't like or we'd wish they included it would be to be able to CC Betty after the conversation is already midway.
Yeah, so
meaning if we've gone, you know, I've sent you an email, you've sent me one back, and I've sent one back, and I'm like, well, you know, I wish this was in a CC Betty form because it's kind of getting, you know, busy. A lot of pictures getting busy. Yeah. I wish I could just CC Betty, and then she, you know, can see, because the entire conversation is there. You know, it depends on the email client, but like you'll get the less than symbol or whatever mm-hmm. along the first column.
Yeah.
To indicate that was the previous email. So, you know, I think it could be done, but it's currently not doing it.
Yeah, so if you CC Betty mid-conversation right now, that first email that you CC her is the conversation starter. And so you can click on it and see all the old replies in the email in the whatever format it is, but it doesn't like go through and parse it and recreate the whole conversation as it should be in Betty, which I think would be really, like you said, really easy for them to do. You just kind of have to look at some of the different popular email clients and how they do it by default and kind of figure it out. I don't think it would be that difficult. And I think it would be really helpful because, like you said, you know, I don't want to send every single email conversation I start to Betty first because then there's just going to be a lot of stuff in there.
Yeah, you don't know.
When we send a little email and all of a sudden, like you said, it starts getting busy. People start doing stuff. It's like, whoa, I need to get Betty in on this so that she can organize it for me. It'd be nice if it had sort of that backlog.
So I'm not too familiar with Outlook. Does it actually show you the picture? Or is it just like an attachment usually?
No, it just usually says you have an attachment.
Okay, so this is going to be great for your Outlook users because they can actually see it. One thing Betty does is it puts all the pictures in an album.
Yeah, exactly.
So like it doesn't matter if the picture was in the first email or the third email, the third reply, it's all going to be in one spot. You're going to be able to see all the different pictures.
So when you look at your conversation on CC Betty, by default, the message view is selected, which is the, you know, it sorts all the emails out as a conversation, which is really useful. But the other views are places. You could just view all the places on there and view all the maps of all the places mentioned in any of the conversations just in one spot. And you can sort, you know, you can sort these by different ways, sender, date sent, all that stuff. Same with images and videos and dates. You know, all these sort of things that it parses out and grabs and makes easier for you, you can just view just those without the messages involved, which is really handy. Like you said, I mean, if you're a Gmail user, these features really aren't killer. It is nice just to have a public, almost public, you know, quote unquote, web space for an email conversation that you could, you know, without having to search through your email if you have a big one or something. But I don't know. I mean, a good email client does a lot of these things for you, but a lot of people can't use a really good email client either. So I don't know. I haven't found the killer use for it for me yet.
For some reason, I can't remember the name of it, but the Twitter, that the threaded Twitter, what's the one, what's it called?
Tweetree.
Tweetree, okay, yeah. Tweetree does kind of a similar thing. It embeds the... So if you got a chance to try out Tweetree, it's kind of like Tweetree for email.
Yeah, exactly.
It keeps the thread in a way you can see it, plus it has the embedded elements to it.
Except for in Twitter, you know, the backlog is always accessible. Like we said, that I mean, this is
where the replies come and go. Yeah, you're right about that. Whereas emails, it's a little bit vague because you're sending the entire, you know, the beginning's emails back in one email. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, it's not. Well,
Gmail's been able to figure it out where the conversation stops and begins.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty smart. But and again, I guess one of my other disclaimers is that I'm not a power email user. I really don't like email that much. I think there are a lot better communication methods out there for me. But some people are really heavy on email. You know, they're checking email for 12 hours in an 8-hour workday. And, you know, it's just not for me. So But I think conceptually this is a great idea. I love services like this where it's, you know, use an existing technology that is being curmudgeon-y and annoying. You can't really, it's not as useful as it should be. And CC Betty, just, you know, you just throw her in the CC. It, you know, it reminded me a lot of I Want Sandy, I think. Sandy, it was an old app by Values of N. Yeah, the Stick It guys. Where she was an account on Twitter. And so if you wanted to remember something, you just at replied to her and said, at reply, at 1 o'clock, I need to do this. And then at 1 o'clock, she would send you a DM.
That's awesome.
You know, it was just, I like these sort of concepts of like, oh, it's a personal assistant. And all you have to do is CC her or at reply Sandy. And these things will get figured out for you.
Yeah.
So it's ccbetty.com. Check it out.
All right, so that about wraps it up for our web apps. If you guys have any web apps that you'd like to share, just send them on into our email or reply us on Twitter.
Faceoffshow.com/feedback. It has all the ways that we receive feedback so people can, you know, let us know.
All right, so we're going to get into the topics. The first topic is kind of a good one. It's called refactoring code, I guess, is the title of it. Mm-hmm. So refactoring is kind of like you're going back through the source code with the goal in mind that you're going to improve the code that's already there without actually adding more features. You're not fixing, you might look for bugs, but you're not fixing bugs. You're going back in to improve the way the code works without changing the way the code outputs.
Yeah. So the way I code, and I'm assuming the way you code, is that we have a problem. We work and work and work and work and work, and then problem X is solved. Okay, move on to next problem. And as much as we try to write good code in the first time, usually you start off writing really good code at the beginning, but then you have a hang-up. You can't figure it out. You're trying to solve this problem, so you hammer at it, and then you finally, after a while, you get it, and you fix it, and you're okay,
I'm done.
Let's move on. That was intense. I don't want to think about that anymore. Let's go to the next one. Refactoring is saying, okay, well, you did that, but go back now and take a look at it and clean it up. You can, but you don't have to radically rewrite it. Just go back and improve it. You know, the readability, the functionality, maybe you're doing a lot of loops when you shouldn't. So you go back and you cut a couple loops out so that, you know, you can reduce your time complexity. Cause I know like when I get in the heat and I'm having trouble solving a problem and it seems impossible to me, I really try some hacked up stuff to get it to work.
Oh yeah.
And then sometimes like you get halfway through your hacked up stuff and you're like, oh no, I just need to do this. And then you're like, okay, it works. Well, that's so fragile. I'm not going to touch it anymore because I'll just break it. Refactoring says, okay, well, you know, later, you know, take a break, settle down, but later come back and look at that code and try and make it better. And there's lots of different ways you can make it better.
Mm-hmm. A simple example of making it better is like, you're going back and you've got a variable named I, you know, for you at the time when you made it, that was just you didn't want to be bothered by thinking of a variable name because it was only an attempt. You weren't even sure it was going to work. And then later on, you know, when you go to refactor it, you say, you know what, I can change that from I to like interest rate or, you know, whatever it stands for.
Yeah.
So that's just a simple example.
Yeah, exactly. And I know what some people are going to say, you know, Jade, I write great code already. Why should I go back and rewrite it? There probably are some people out there that plan and think ahead enough. I worked at a company where my boss told me that once he had to take this computer test, this programming test. They took this class and they had this test, and they had an hour to do the test. And so they're given this really hard problem, and you know they're given the problem, and every student just start, you know, typing away, start writing code. And he said that there was this guy that sat there. He just kicked back, closed his eyes, and sat there and thought. Everyone else is going crazy, looking at him, you know,
no
like,
way.
Are you stupid? You're not going to get this done. What an idiot, you know? And that guy sat back and thought and thought and thought. And then about a half hour, halfway through the test, he, you know, opened his eyes and he started typing. And he got done. I think he was done in 10 minutes or 15 minutes after that. He was the first one done with the test. And he obviously thought about the problem enough, thought about how he wanted his code to look in his head that he could, I'm sure he probably wrote great code that probably couldn't be refactored. I mean, he planned enough. Most of us don't do that or aren't able to do that. You know, as much as we want to try and plan, we either want to just get into it and start getting the program done, or we come up with there's problems or hangups that we wouldn't have thought about. In the first place.
Some solutions are so complex you can't think of them while you're designing. I mean, you've got to kind of work at it and then, you know, refactor as you're going. At least that's how I program sometimes.
So, I mean, Mark, how do I know when I should refactor my code? I mean, what are some symptoms?
In programmers' lingo, they call it code smell. You know, your code smells like there's some problems with it. It might not necessarily mean there's a problem, but here's some of the code smells. One, duplicate code. If you have the exact same lines of code in one area of your program and in another, there's chances are that there's something wrong there. Another one is a large class. Maybe your class is like 3 pages long or something, or who knows, some kind of a code metric. That might indicate that that class should be broken up into a smaller class. A duplicate method where you just take that same exact method and just throw it into another class or something.
Yeah, exactly.
It might not necessarily be bad, but you might want to look at it.
In PHP especially, I did a lot of that. I mean, you're like, oh, I already did this somewhere else. You know, open it up, copy and paste, instead of really thinking about how I should do it in a good object-oriented manner.
Yep. And I read one of the things is the first time you just do it, the second time, you know, you copy and paste it because it's the easiest thing to do, and the third time you do that action, like what you're talking about, you're ready to copy and paste it again, you should probably refactor.
Yep. Exactly.
So that's what like a code smell is.
So what a lot of people are thinking, and this is a big problem with refactoring code, is that, well, you know, there's all, what if I want to get into refactoring my code? I mean, that is a big task. I don't want to rewrite my whole program. Well, while that may be, you know, say conceptually the right way to go, a lot of programmers have adopted what they call the Boy Scout rule. And what it says, you know, I don't know, Boy Scouts have this little rule. They say when they go to a campsite, no matter what, they leave it better than when they found it. You know, okay. They use it and then they leave it, they clean it up and they leave it better than the way it was when they came. Well, you can apply the same principle to refactoring code. You come in, you know, even if you just have to fix a little bug in a little method, you go through and then after you fixed it, look at it and see if you can do some little things to refactor, like add some comments. Maybe it needs some more comments. Change some variable names to make them more clear. Leave that little chunk of code better than when you found it, because, you know, the Boy Scouts just can't in one single, you know, year or whatever, just clean every campsite ever in the woods. It's just too big of a task. But by doing that, it's like, well, we're going to use it, but we're going to improve it and stick to our guns is that we need to be rewriting cleaner code and better code.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
So Mark Fowler was a guy that wrote basically, you know, to say it, he wrote the book on refactoring. I mean, literally it's like a very popular book on refactoring. And he's saying, you know, refactoring is not just a way to, you know, understand the code better or, you know, make it optimized or work better, but he found that it helps to find bugs as well. It's one of the other benefits.
Yeah, and I mean that makes sense to me. It's like
because you're really analyzing the code.
Yeah, and sort of one of the benefits of an open source project is that code is constantly being refactored by a bunch of people. So, let's say Microsoft, even if they implement, you know, I hate picking on Microsoft, of course, because everyone then thinks you're just a jerk, but, a closed source project, they have 12 people that may or may not find time to refactor, because it's hard to justify refactoring to business people because, you know, you're like, well, you don't understand. This is making the code easier to maintain. And they're like, well, no, my client just wants this done. Let's just get this feature done. You know, closed source, there's a team of like 16 developers, let's say, and if they get some time and can, you know, sort of do it when their boss isn't looking, refactor some code, that's great. That's better than not. But in an open source community, I mean, people might just be looking at the code and they're like, oh, this is not right. So, I mean, a lot of security bugs can be fixed that way, because if you're going to go refactor code, you're like, oh, whoa, that is a big vulnerability.
Oh, I found you didn't validate the input.
Yeah, exactly. So I need to fix that and then do it the right way and clean up the code a little bit.
Okay. So yeah, refactoring is great. Now, I mean, you've been kind of studying the agile stuff. What is kind of the methodology? I mean, do you try to make perfect code the first time, or you just try to just hack something that works?
A lot of agile stuff says that you shouldn't. So one of the things I'm studying is a method called Scrum, and kind of the way it works is it says, okay, first write tests for your development
before you even write code.
Yeah, I guess we should probably talk about that first. Test-driven development really helps your ability to refactor. So what you do is before you code, you write your tests. You know, all my tests should do this. Okay, my code should be able to do this. Then you write it so it works, right? Okay, it passes all the tests. It does what it's supposed to. Great. Then you can go back on your own time or at whatever pace you want and refactor code. And it's easy to tell that it's not breaking everything, because you can just run your tests again and it'll tell you whether or not everything works.
So you don't have to do it by hand. You don't have to go back and say, oh, well, my code works. It's just run this little script.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to go through and do all that sort of manual testing that we all do where it's like, put in all kinds of junk in this box and see if it still breaks. Okay, no. You know, tests will just automate that process for you because a lot of times what you find when you refactor code without tests, you'll change one thing. And you're like, there's no way that could break anything else. I mean, come on. But what you're not realizing is other people may have used your code under the assumption, you know, and if you write that test, all your assumptions, if you write good tests, should be met. Like, this code should only accept this and only return this so someone else can use your code in the program. You know, okay, this method does what I want, so I'll use it. And if you go and change it, you know, they're using your test as assumptions. So they can say, oh, and if you go and change it, if you like, let's say you're like, oh, this should do this and go change your test. Well, when you run the suite of tests again, you should see his test breaking as well. Mm-hmm. So you can know, oh, okay, he made an assumption. I need to let him know that I'm changing the way this is working. So he's going to want to change the way he does stuff or go fix it yourself.
Right. Yeah. And another thing too is like, if you make a change that has a huge impact on all the other classes, like a variable name change or something, or a function change, or a class name change that might, you know, affect 20 other, you know, places in the code. If you change that name and you just run your test and everything still works again, it's like no big deal.
Yeah, you're like,
but
okay.
If it breaks, it'll tell you exactly where you need to go edit mm-hmm. those other parts of the code.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we'd like to all think that we use correct object-oriented encapsulation, but you never know. Someone could be accessing a variable manually through the mm-hmm. object, and you're like, uh-oh, well, now you know, because their stuff will break as well. You're like, that little change, something as simple as changing the variable name to make it more clear and understandable to someone else reading your code could have other consequences. So you know, with agile stuff, you write the test beforehand. You make it, you write it so it works. You're like, okay, it works. Good. Problem is solved. It works and it does it the way it should. Then you go back and refactor your code as much as you can, because with some of these, they're trying to set like specific work cycles. So you know, you work until you make sure it works and it's good. It passes the test. It does what it does. Okay, you know, I could turn that in to a customer if I had to. You know, if the week comes by and they say, did you get this done? You could say, yes, it does do that. But then you have your test written, so you can go back and easily refactor code to make it better and easy to maintain, you know, more readable for other people that might come into the future, with having a system in place to let you know if you've broke anything else in the system. Because the whole point, like a lot of agile stuff, is that within, you know, a certain period of time, you deliver a chunk of the product that is exactly the way it should be. You know, it's programmed right with, you know, it's been cleaned up, it's been maintained, they've been tested for bugs and things like that. So, you know, refactoring helps that because you're able to write, you know, cleaner code. I mean, when you're working on a big problem, it seems really clear to you sometimes. But like we said last episode, if you look at it 6 months later, you're like, whoa, what
Why
was
did I, do
I
this
thinking? Or... Yeah, so that gives you the ability to say, all right, I know this code is kind of more mangled up than it should be. I can go back and fix it without knowing I'm breaking anything else.
Yeah. Okay. So what's our next topic?
The next topic I want to talk about, and you kind of hit it already a little bit, is called code metrics. And code metrics are sort of analytical tools that look at your code and give you sort of detailed information about its characteristics. So one of the things you talked about was code smell. They're actually trying to come up with metrics, you know, a code metric for code smell. Things like, looking at how long these methods are, things like that, you know. So what this does is it allows you to sort of run it against your whole suite or your whole system at once and give you the overall view of what your code is looking like.
Kind of like analytics of code or something like statistics.
Yeah, exactly. So, so there's a lot of metrics out there, and it would be impossible to talk about them all. But some of the good ones, like, so there's a test thing out here called Source Monitor. I read an article. It'll be in the show notes on Siski's blog. I don't know how to pronounce that. But so he runs this suite, and it sort of looks at, you know, five or six big things like, what percent of your code is comments?
Okay,
that
sounds very to me useful. Like a good metric.
Yeah, what percent of your code has documentations in it? So if you're working with like a good framework like, you know, Ruby or Java, you know, they have built-in documentation frameworks into them. You know, what percent of that code of your total code is docs? You know, how many methods and classes do you have? What is the maximum complexity of your code? What is your max depth of your code?
Is that like how many nested ifs and
things? Yeah, like exactly. That? Yeah. So it kind of looks at, you know, your tabulation to see like how deep does it go? Well, maybe if you go in, you know, three levels deep, maybe a chunk of that code should be brought out as its own method. And so with this source monitor, you're able to set your own thresholds. And this is the important part. People will get angry because they're going to say, well, every project's different and every code's different. Well, with a lot of these, you set your own sort of, you know, threshold for this.
I would say certain programming languages would have different metric means too.
Exactly. So, and the thing is, so a lot of, I don't speak from experience, but what I read was a lot of programmers immediately hate the idea of code matrix because they think the way it's been in the past is it's usually the business people looking at their code, sort of applying arbitrary limitations and then saying, well, you guys are writing bad code. And it's not. There's a lot of things you can do with code metrics, and they're never right or wrong. It's just a good way to look at things. So you can look at where your code is lacking. So let's say, you know, even if you don't set a threshold, if you're like, wow, we're doing everything right except for a large percent of our code is not commented at all. You know, let's say, you know, less than 1% of my code is comments. You're like, well, yeah, that's, you know, and if you're doing a big project, that's a lot of stuff that needs comments. Okay, well, do you know where you need to maybe focus from now on? You can compare developers. Like one thing I was thinking of is if you could use this to sort of compare developer styles, like let's say give two developers the same task and then run code metrics on it. You can like, well, this person
seems to work better in this area.
Has really, you know, these same styles of code. You can almost compare them and be like, okay, well, you know, they tend to, you know, these code metrics say that these guys do a lot of the same type of coding. They'll probably work really well together.
Oh, that's good.
Or if you have like one guy that, you know, is completely opposite of the other, they're probably going to butt heads a lot because one guy's going to be like, well, you need to comment more. And then it's going to be like, well, you know, you need to code more because you're not getting as much done as me.
I could say this is a tool to test and improve your methodologies too. Like we talked about pair programming and how it might improve code quality. And you could do some kind of a metric like bugs per line of code or something and see if, you know, your single developer team is, you know, better than a pair programming team. Do some in-house studies.
Yeah, that's like a traditional sort of code metric is like bugs per line of code. And you got to be careful because that's some of the business process stuff that programmers will kind of immediately like get standoffish about.
Okay.
But again, like you said, I'm thinking about it more internally than from the business standpoint. A team of coders using code metrics on themselves to better improve themselves. Like one thing you could do, I was thinking of, is if you're working on a project, and let's say you and I really like WordPress, and we just don't know kind of where we stand. Like, are we doing as good a stuff as WordPress? I just can't really tell. You know, on the inside, underneath the hood,
mm-hmm.
You can run code metrics on your project and their project and kind of see where it stacks up. Like, oh man, this company is doing a lot more comments than I am and a lot more documentation. Maybe I should step it up because, you know, that's why WordPress is so good. You can go in the documentation and get help really easily.
So is it usually kind of like a program that goes through this, or is there just a bunch of different ways to do it?
Well, there's two styles. The sort of traditional style is stuff, numbers that kind of just get ran by hand, like bugs per line of code. Okay, we had X number of bugs reported in our tracker. Okay, you scan a thing. We have X lines of code. Okay, this is, you know, we have this many developers and this many lines of code, but there's a lot of new ones that come and actually scour your source code and look at it. So one of the things you talked about before was code smell.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at this thing. You know, I'm doing some Ruby stuff at work, so I'm kind of using a lot of Ruby stuff. So I hope people bear with me because, you know, we're doing a lot of Rails stuff, and that's what I know the best. But we found this one called Metric Foo. And what it does is it actually takes a bunch of different Ruby code metrics sort of things and mushes them together into one thing. So the one thing that actually looks at code smell is called Reek, oddly enough. So it's like, does your code...
I like clever names for software.
Yeah, exactly. Like, does your code reek? Ooh, God, that's stinky code. And so, you know, it goes through and uses all these... Actually, it's kind of an aggregate of different code metric things and gives you sort of a detailed report using a whole bunch of different metrics, which is also another way to kind of do it. You can say, you know, if you don't trust the metrics, well, then let's just get a bunch of different metrics and aggregate them and just look at them as a whole. It's not meant to be like, well, you're doing a bad job because your code metrics say so. It's, you know, to look at yourself internally and see how you're doing against your other developers, against other teams, and just overall how your code's looking. So try not to, you know, don't let it be a negative thing. Like, mm-hmm. This is the business guy is trying to tell us why, you know, trying to justify whether or not they should fire us by bringing in a consultant that's going to do code metrics.
Okay. Would you say code metrics are, you know, something that's easy to apply to code, or I mean, is it going to take a while to generate some of these reports?
It doesn't seem to be too bad at all. Like this Ruby one is just, it's a package called Metric Foo, and you run it on it and it'll just kind of garble through your source code and spit out some metrics. I didn't have any code to actually run on myself. I don't have any substantial code, but they're getting automated now as software. It's software looking at software as opposed to a human looking at software and kind of making arbitrary metrics like bugs per line of code. You know, that's really simple. These are trying to take a deeper look at your programming. I have to look at it as a programmer would look, you know, for things about it.
It'd be interesting to download, like, I don't know, 50 or 100 open source, you know, projects, like, let's say, you know, like PHP projects or something, and just run the metrics on them and then compare all the different ones and just,
yeah, exactly.
It'd be really interesting.
That's a great idea, because you could just say, I mean, that would just be a good article for any sort of website. Like, this is what I ran on all these projects and this is what I'm finding, and get some detailed report on it, because it'd be cool to see what other people are doing out there and compare. That's, I think, one of the cool things is to compare yourself with other developers or compare yourself with other projects. Like, okay, this is the code we're spitting out. What code are these other teams spitting out? You know, they're doing a lot better than us. Maybe that's part of it. Maybe it's because they have a lot more documentation. They can refactor quickly because they have a lot more tests.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe they have more bugs of line or yeah, more bugs per line in their code at the beginning, but they have more documentation and more tests, so they can come back and just refactor it.
Exactly,
just
make it faster without any more. One thing we talked about when Paul Levesque was on the show was, maybe we talked about it after the show, was this thing called Heckle.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a thing that actually will go through and check the robustness of your tests. So that's, I mean, this is a code metric of how well your tests are. Like, it'll go through and, you know, okay, well, these, you know, you have 20 tests that are really easy to break.
Yeah, it just
so
swaps.
They need to be better tests.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of metrics out there, and a lot of these more active communities like Java and Ruby are really pushing for these things and doing a lot to try and make it easier for people to do it.
Yeah, it all comes back. I mean, I think it's a big part of the agile movement. I mean, I think it's like kind of like, you know, you make code just to work at first and then refactor it and test it and then, you know, check your code metrics on it, see if you can do a better job. You know,
yeah, exactly. I mean, the old sort of the attitude just used to be, you know, program to get it done, program to get it done. You just want the problem done. And now, I mean, the industry is really maturing a lot more. There's a lot more programmers just out in the market in general. So they're coming up with ways to say, well, how can we do this better rather than just getting it done? Because I'm looking at, you know, maintaining someone else's code and it's terrible. So we need processes in place to do that. One thing I've heard from Paul is he says that one of the reasons he thinks that Ruby and Ruby on Rails has really shot off is that Rails is 100% tested. And so it's easy to accept bug fixes from outside people, because you just say, you know, you submit a report of the test not passing based on a certain input, and then you submit your change, and then the test now passing with your input. So you're like, okay, well, I did it better. This was a bug, but now you can see, here's proof. Here's the test before. I wrote my code, and now here's the test after passing.
So they can almost just throw it in without even reviewing it very closely.
Exactly. Exactly. You don't have to. And then again, if someone goes through and they're like, well, I think this is written pretty poorly, like, just this happens a lot. Yeah, exactly. They can refactor it and just run the test, no big problem. But, you know, back to code metrics, it's just this sort of way of, you know, looking outside of your code rather than just writing it and getting it done and figuring out a way to do it better. And sort of saying that, you know, maybe I might not be the person maintaining this in the future, so maybe we should try and do things to make it easier for people to do it in the future that aren't me.
So I think the traditional way used to be like, you know, we've got a problem, solve it the first time, and it's going to be perfect. If it's not perfect, we'll make a version 2 and either rewrite it all or just kind of go through it. I think this is saying it's embracing the fact that programmers can't do it perfect the first try.
Yeah.
Or they tend not to. And so what they do is they say, don't worry about it. Just write your test and just make it work. Don't get focused. Don't get caught up on just optimizing it and making it perfect the first time. Just get it to work. And then once you got it to work, then go back and refactor it. And then, you know, do the metrics on it and see if you can do better.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it would be great. Think about this. If you can run metrics on code that you wrote a year ago and a code you wrote now.
Ooh, that's another point.
You know,
if you're improving.
Yeah, exactly. Like, okay, I'm doing a lot better. I mean, I kind of harp on this a lot, but I'm doing better at commenting my code. I'm doing it a lot more. I mean, a metric can't look at a comment to see if it's good or if it's useful, yeah. But it can look at it to see if it's there, which is a big problem. I'd rather have a comment there than a comment there that might not be useful than no comment at all.
Yeah, well, but it could. here's an example. If you got 80 lines of code and one line of comment, it's probably not the best situation.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it can't say, maybe that comment's the best comment in the world and it explains all 80 lines just perfectly, but I doubt it.
Yeah, it could happen. You never know. You just, you're like, the one big comment at the beginning is like, line 65, I decided to do this. Line, that would be such a pain in the butt. Because you'd be like at line 85, you'd be like, what's going on here? And you have to scroll back up. That'd be terrible.
But at the same time, though, you could also have too many. You could be commenting every single line and then you just got to scroll forever.
Exactly. Or if you're doing a bunch of comments for a three line method, that's not right. You know, you're doing it wrong in that case. But it's just a good way to create sort of a standard of comparison. That's the thing. It doesn't have to be right, wrong, good or bad. It just creates a standard of comparison so you can look at people. It's funny. We talk about there's ways to do this with people, and none of them are perfect. You know, there's Myers-Briggs. I just did one called StrengthsFinder. Mm-hmm. And none of them are perfect. None of them ever work. But what they do is they create sort of a good base for standard of comparison so that you can look at each other and see, you know, how different you are with a standard instead of just, you know, looking and assessing. Like, I could look at someone's code and be like, nah, that's not good enough. You know, that's, your methods are too long. But how long? I mean, this applies some mathematics to it, and you can say, well, on average, you're writing twice as long methods as everyone else. So you might want to think about trying to look at it and do it in a more object-oriented way. Pull some of the stuff that you're doing out a lot. You know, you have a lot of duplicate code. You know, you have the same, you know, code smell. You have a lot of the same thing happening a lot. Make that, you need to notice that ahead of time and make that a method as part of your planning of that object and programming.
So this code metric thing is for Ruby. Obviously, there's other metric programs for other languages, other ways to detect code smell. Java's got one built into Eclipse. NetBeans, you know, Visual Studio's got one. So this isn't just a Ruby thing. Although we talk about Ruby a little bit. We talk about it a lot on here, just because that's, you know, what you're kind of studying a little
bit.
Yeah,
exactly.
This applies to a lot of languages. I mean, refactoring is pretty much every language it can be applied to.
Oh yeah, well, refactoring needs to be done in every language. I mean, even JavaScript. Does some of my JavaScript need some refactoring? I can guarantee you that. But yeah, no, it's definitely not attached to Ruby. There's all kinds of them. You can even apply generic ones, you know, to your code to look at what it is. There's some that you don't even need a program to do. Things like, you know, lines of code, you know, lines per method,
lines of code. That's easy. You know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not just attached to Ruby. I just found I thought the Ruby one was really cool because it took a lot of different ones and aggregated them into sort of one suite so you can run them all really easily as once. Because that's the thing you'll find with code metrics. It's the same as what we talked about with like Myers-Briggs for people and stuff. There's a lot of them out there and none of them are ever perfect. So why not try and get as many of them as you can and just kind of aggregate them and average them and see where you're standing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, run some code metrics maybe, and that'll get, you know, that can give you some hints as to where you should go and refactor your code.
Yep. Look for some code smells like duplicate code or...
Exactly. All right. Well, that about wraps it up for this episode of Face Off, Mark. We'd like to remind our listeners that you can subscribe to our show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can also leave feedback for your show using various methods by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. I want to know. Actually, I want to pose a question to our listeners. What code metrics are you guys using?
How many times do you refactor? Do you refactor at all?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know I haven't in the past, but what I'm hoping to do is I'm going to try and do this a project in Rails here because I need to you know, learn little Rails because everyone around me is doing it. So I'm going to be doing, you know, test-driven development with it. I'm going to be, you know, which should help me refactor, and maybe I'll even run some code metrics on it and I can share it via Twitter so everyone can see what kind of code I write, although I'm not sure if I'm ready to open that can of worms yet. So, yeah, let us know, you know, what your thoughts on refactoring, if you are doing it, and, you know, what code metrics you guys like or which ones you don't like, because we found that there was quite a response on the internet. People thought that there's a lot of code metrics that were a bunch of bunk, and people thought just, you know, gave a bad impression of them. So let us know. We're very curious, actually, what you professional programmers are out there doing, and, you know, your thoughts on our topics. So we'll see you guys next week.